This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Tonight, it's now a historic emergency. The largest fire ever in California, now bigger than the size of Los Angeles.
That's the Mendocino Complex fire. And officials warn that it won't be fully contained until September. The car fire, meanwhile, has damaged 1,000 homes. Arson is thought to be the cause of the Holy Fire, which has forced the evacuation of 20,000 people. The charges against the suspect could land him in jail for life.
As firefighters try to manage the 15 wide-scale blazes in California, across the Atlantic, Spain and Portugal are also battling raging wildfires. Last month, we heard the story of Greek citizens fleeing a fire into the sea and drowning.
It was like a sea of fire, a wave of fire.
This year's conflagrations have made familiar landscapes alien to us. But one thing in these fiery times remains unchanged: presidential politicking via Twitter.
California wildfires are being magnified and made so much worse by the bad environmental laws, which aren't allowing massive amounts of readily available water to be properly utilized. It is being diverted into the Pacific Ocean. Must also tree clear to stop fire from spreading.
I have no idea what he's talking about. Wildland fires are not like urban fires. It's not just a case of opening a hydrant and squirting water.
Stephen J. Pine is a former firefighter, self-described pyromantic, and author of 25 books on wildland fires.
You would have to divert the Sacramento River to put those fires out. So that is just nonsense from start to finish. I don't know what that's about, except just a way to beat up on environmental issues. One of the things about fire is that it is very often used to animate some other message. If you've got a theme, a topic, something you want to promote, if you can put a picture or footage of fire, you're going to get attention. And that's what I suspect is going on here. But fire has its own story. It has its own problems with reporting and journalism.
And let's get to those. What do the media tend to get the most wrong?
Well, they've always relied on two templates. One is fire is a disaster.
Oh, it seems like we just got done with last year's fire season here in California, which was nothing short of disastrous. And here we go again. Sadly.
Fire often is a disaster, but not only a disaster. And the other is
fighting these fires has been like waging a war.
The firefight is battlefield.
More than 4,000 firefighters continue to battle the Mendocino Complex fires.
We're not at war with fire. And if we are, we're going to take a lot of casualties, we're going to spend a lot of money, and we're going to lose. If I were to frame the larger story, and I do this as a fire historian, I would say the problem is that we have too much bad fire, too little good fire, and too much combustion. And that means we have too many fires that are burning communities, killing people. At the same time, we have too few good fires, substituting for them, getting our landscapes into a more habitable shape. And as far as the business of houses burning, it really bubbled up in California in the post-war era, considered a kind of California quirk, and then suddenly it's all over the West. But it's not staying in the West. It's burned outside Austin, Texas.
Several are burning near the capital city of Austin, and the only way to battle the quick-moving fires is from the air.
In Gatlinburg, Tennessee, it's burning out along the coastal plains.
The people here, they're surprised, they're devastated.
More than 14,000 people fled Gatlinburg that night.
It's not something that can be quarantined off in California or just restricted as another freak of Western violence like grizzly bear attacks or something. Suddenly, this is a national problem.
I want to ask you about this notion of good fire and bad fire.
Mm-hmm.
Fires that burn a lot of timber have their place in the life cycle of forests. How is that so?
fires started on Earth as soon as plants colonized the land. It emerges out of life. Life created the oxygen. Life created the fuel. Think of this as creative destruction in nature's economy. By removing fire or trying to remove fire, we've deteriorated the ecological health and integrity of these systems, and one of the manifestations is to allow a pileup of combustibles that make more dangerous and damaging fires possible.
Then there's managed fires that are created as a firefighting tool.
Well, this is actually a very ancient practice. Part of what made us human was being able to cook. And in a sense, we soon learned to cook landscapes. And to be able to distribute fire on the landscape is an enormous power.
But particularly over the last number of decades, strategies for managing fire have changed. What was the turning point in the United States?
The Great Fires of 1910 put us into a kind of full suppression mode. It traumatized the young Forest Service. And for 50 years, the country tried to remove fire from lands as much as it could. By the 1960s, the consequences of that were becoming more and more apparent. A real deterioration of many landscapes, a lot of grasslands were being overtaken by woody plants and becoming really unattractive and unusable, as well as major fire traps. So in 1968, the National Park Service adopted a fire restoration program. By 1978, the Forest Service had come on board. So all of the apparatus were all in place 40 to 50 years ago. And it was predicted if we didn't solve this, we would have ever-growing fire problems. The 70s and early 80s were really the last time all the contributing factors were more or less benign enough that if we moved at scale, we could have deflected the trajectory of the whole system.
And then what happened? And I actually know the answer to this. It's Yellowstone.
1988, Yellowstone burned and kept burning week after week for several months, and the media camped out there.
Fires bore down on a national icon, the Old Faithful Inn.
There are a lot of angry people who believe that the National Park Service is responsible that it let the fires burn too freely for too long.
The New York Times documentary series Retro Report delved into the public pressure officials faced as the wildfire ravaged the park.
President Reagan moved to deal with a firestorm of protest over his administration's let it burn policy.
Area ranchers said the let it burn attitude makes no sense.
And by then, everything is working in the wrong direction, and it has been a steady ratcheting up of worsening conditions. And it's very unlikely that we will be able to get ahead of them, except in very local areas. There's no reason for communities to be burning. We know how to keep houses from burning. We just have to rethink and commit to doing it.
Well, what could we have done to prevent those 1,000 homes that have been rendered cinders in the car fire?
Well, the main vehicle for taking out these houses are not these tsunamis of flame. It's blizzards of sparks, millions of embers flying around ahead of the fire. And if there is any point of vulnerability in the house, the roof, combustible vegetation right next to wooden siding, then that becomes a point of ignition. Once you get several houses on the fringe burning, then it becomes an urban fire and it's simply going house to house. How did we solve the urban fire problem? Well, by codes, zoning, ordinances, hardening those houses, identifying the points of vulnerability. Some communities are now proactively putting in these kinds of considerations into new construction, but what do we do with 40 or 50 years of poorly conceived construction? How do we retrofit? Because if we don't do it, fire will do it for us.
A recent cover of The Economist shows firefighters facing a blaze, and the headline is, "In the Line of Fire, Losing the War Against Climate Change." Is that making too big an assumption?
Well, I think that's another example of using fire to animate another topic. You know, fire is a reaction, and I think of it as a driverless car. It's barreling down the highway, integrating everything around it. And it sometimes this may be, you know, a tricky intersection that we call wildland-urban interface. It may be a dangerous curve we call climate change. It may be a lot of road debris. We would still have a fire problem if the climate was the same as it had been in the 70s. But climate change is certainly aggravating and acting on that.
Are we indeed in a crisis, or is this just a little bit more of the same?
Well, it's more of the same, but if you want to get media or political or public attention, you've got to burn up a bunch of houses and kill people or involve celebrities. So 400 acres outside Santa Barbara, California is worth 400,000 outside Winnemucca. In fact, Winnemucca had 450,000 acres burned earlier this year, and I don't think anybody knew about it. But there's a deeper story in which there's a slow disaster unfolding, which is the absence of good fire in so many places that need it. And in the absence of tame fire, we're just going to have feral fires, which is what we're seeing.
So I'm an editor. Your advice to me is to go to Florida. That's where they're doing managed fires, and see if that policy might be exported elsewhere, even the hedonists in Southern California.
Well, we've been trying for 50 years to export the Florida model, and it hasn't worked as well as we'd like. And I think what Western fire officers are now doing is trying to work with fire, a managed wildfire, if you can accept that. They're half suppression, half prescribed fire. It's a very interesting fusion, different from what we see in Florida, different from what we've had before. And I think we're seeing a phase change, at least in the wildland fire community, in that direction.
We've been talking about the overall ecosystem. And we've also talked a bit about the media ecosystem, how we tend to focus on celebrities and, you know, multi-million dollar houses cantilevered over some canyon. Is the media ecosystem making it harder for us as a society to deal with the overall realities of wildfires?
You know, the media ecosystem is following the public ecosystem. This is what people want to hear. You expect to see air tankers flying around, giant helicopters dropping water, whether they're really helpful or not. There's a certain amount of political theater, a certain amount of media display. So I don't necessarily blame the media. I would like the media to begin shifting, nudging, if you will, the story. But where is the human drama narrative, the interest narrative that is going to allow the media to tell this other story in a way that doesn't penalize them? You know, you're putting on this new story and your competitor is putting on the old, here we are, the troops out fighting the fire. It's a disaster raging. Who's going to get the audience? So we need to come up with good, tough, working narratives that can serve our purpose. And I don't know that that's the job of the media. It would be great if you did it, but I think that's also the task of academics and writers and artists and the rest of us to give you something that can be as compelling as the firefight, because we're not going to get ahead of these problems. Very few of them are under the control of the fire community itself. You know, it's an old saying, it's better to be lucky than good, and we better hope we're lucky in the next decade or so.
Steve, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome.
Fire historian Stephen J. Pine is a professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University.
Coming up, the reporter who's covered more than 400 Texas executions is retiring, but plans to keep attending.
This is On the Media.